Principles of Economics, My Complete Guide to Understanding Economics, is now available in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook from SaifEddin.com, Amazon, and many more booksellers worldwide. And now, I am also teaching a course based on this book on my website, SaifEddin.com. Principles of Economics will run the whole academic year, from September to June, and will have a new lecture every 2 weeks, as well as weekly live online discussion seminars open to learners from all over the world and from all walks of life. Whether you're a student, a professional, or a retiree, you are making economic decisions every day, and this course will arm you with the wisdom of centuries of economists to improve your economic decision-making. You'll also get a free book of Principles of Economics if you sign up for the course. Go to SaifEddin.com and sign up now. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by Orange Pill App, the Bitcoin-only social network that connects you with high-signal Bitcoiners, events, and now merchants as well. If you're like me and can't stop talking about Bitcoin, you know how challenging it can be to talk to the no-coiners and how nice it is to talk to someone who gets you. With the Orange Pill app, you can find the Bitcoiners near you and they can replace the no-coiners in your life. You can organize events and meetups with local Bitcoiners, and wherever you travel, you can meet up with local Bitcoiners all while being as anonymous as you like. So if you want to build your local network of Bitcoiners, find a Bitcoin meetup or merchants accepting Bitcoin, head over to orangepillapp.com to sign up or download the app from the App Store or Google Play Store and send me a DM so we can get connected. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by CoinKite. CoinKite are my favorite makers of Bitcoin hardware. They produce the legendary OpenDime, the first Bitcoin bearer asset, as well as the reliable Cold Card hardware wallet, the excellent stainless steel seed plates for storing your seed phrases, and the block clock. Now, CoinKite have produced the Sats card, a card the size of a credit card which can store Bitcoin and works great as a gift. CoinKite have just produced a limited edition gorgeous Bitcoin Standard Sats card, which carries the Bitcoin Standard logo, and you can get it from coinkite.shop/Bitcoin Standard. Use the code Bitcoin Standard to get 5% off your purchase. This podcast is also brought to you by the Bitcoin Way, your professional Bitcoin IT team offering you personalized, secure, and comprehensive solutions for every step along your Bitcoin journey. The Bitcoin Way offer live concierge service to guide you with your Bitcoin cold storage, running your node, privacy best practices, inheritance planning, corporate strategy, and multi-sig solutions. They don't touch your coins, they guide you through the process of acquiring your coins and securing them. If you'd like to make your setup safer and more reliable, book a consult with them and see what they have to suggest. If you want to give someone the gift of Bitcoin, get them this professional service that will ensure they start off knowing exactly how to manage their coins and not lose them. Go to thebitcoinway.com and start Bitcoining more confidently. Hello, welcome to another episode of the Bitcoin Standard Podcast. Our guest today is Professor Jeffrey Sachs, who is the director of the Center for Sustainable Development at Columbia University, where he holds the rank of university professor. He was director of the Earth Institute from 2002 to 2016. He is president of the UN Sustainable Development Solutions Network and has served as special advisor to UN Secretaries Generals Kofi Annan, Ban Ki-moon, and Antonio Guterres. But perhaps more important than all of that, as far as I'm concerned, is Professor Sachs was my professor at Columbia University 20 years ago.
And for me, that's what's important too. So that's cool.
20 years ago. It was 20 years ago when I joined Columbia, 2004, which is incredible to think how time flies.
My God.
20 years ago, I joined the Columbia University PhD program in sustainable development, which Professor Sachs directs. He was the director of the program. I spent 5 years there, which I learned quite a lot. I've not spoken to Professor Sachs in a while, but given recent events and what he's been saying, I thought it would be great to bring him along and to get his opinion on a subject that he's been very vocal on, which is the genocide in Gaza. Thank you so much for joining, Professor. Thank you so much for all of the outspoken positions you have taken, which couldn't have been easy in today's environment. And thank you for giving us the time.
Oh, it's great. So great to be with you. And congratulations on all you're doing. It's amazing. We're proud of you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So I guess let's get straight into it. What is your opinion of what is going on in Gaza right now?
Well, it's a genocide. And I think the International Court of Justice will most likely reach that definitive conclusion when it makes its final decision. It made an interim decision saying that there were plausible grounds that Israel is committing a genocide. More recently, the special rapporteur of the Human Rights Council has also said that Israel is making genocidal actions according to the standards of the 1948 Genocide Convention. So genocide is, of course, is a horrific crime, but it's also a legal standard. It's based on a global convention that was promulgated and adopted in 1948 after the Holocaust. And it puts forward rigorous conditions, and it seems to me that Israel is violating those conditions. Ultimately, while there's the very practical issue of the war and the deaths, and that is a practical issue for politics, diplomats, statesmen, and the like, there's also a legal standard which will be adjudicated. Which, to my mind, points to this completely shocking and awful fact that we are most likely seeing a genocide before our eyes, and it's been going on for months. And the world, not the world, the big powers, and especially the United States, are unwilling, unable to take basic actions to stop it. So the difference of this and the Holocaust or other earlier genocides is that they weren't recorded day by day on video. And now we see live coverage. We see journalistic reports, albeit Israel is almost surely targeting and killing journalists in large numbers. This is another basic fact in an attempt to hide what's going on. But Israeli soldiers in the Israeli Defense Forces themselves post their own videos celebrating the destruction of Gaza. So we see day to day, and yet the world doesn't stop it.
Yeah, it's absolutely devastating to be watching this. The toll that it has taken on people for 6 months is just insane. I think I agree with you, obviously. And I think one thing that is perhaps unique about this genocide, as far as I can tell, I don't think there are many genocides where the leaders of the perpetrating army were quite so vocal and so clear about the fact that they are out there to destroy an entire population. I mean, it's just... If Palestinians had tried to fabricate fake quotes made by Israeli leaders, I don't think they could have come up with something as damning as what the Israeli leaders themselves have said. I mean, you have the president of Israel who said there is no such thing as an innocent civilian in Gaza. We're talking about a population of 2.3 million people, half of which is under the age of 18, roughly, and so a very large number of children. And he's just out there saying, you know, for us, there are no innocent civilians. The prime minister of Israel is also going on about invoking verses from the Bible, which specifically instruct to spare no child, no woman, not even spare their cattle. And this is what the soldiers are singing about and posting on YouTube. We've never had anything like this. I think perhaps in the Rwandan genocide, there was some kind of public attempt, but people, the world wasn't paying attention. So it wasn't as if the Rwandan leadership was getting on CNN and saying, no, there is no such thing as innocence there. But here we do. We have it. It's all being televised and all being transmitted. And it's startling.
Yeah, what I think is very interesting about this is, first, these statements, these videos are all being listed, recorded, and submitted to the International Court of Justice. So this is the body of evidence. And as you say, the Israeli leaders have made their own body of evidence. They haven't hidden it. You just watch, and it's unbelievable. Second, it's clear that they live in a bubble. They're talking to their own followers. They're at rallies as if no one else is listening, but they're all being recorded and then translated. Third, they think, I'm sensing that by speaking in Hebrew, they're not speaking to the world, but the world hears all of this. It's not so hard to translate, subtitles to the videos. I think what you said is extremely right and important about the biblical quotations, because there's something, complicated going on. Israeli society is multi-layered. There are many secular Jews who are afraid, and they are subject to fear and fear-mongering. There are also highly religious Jews who live in a biblical or Talmudic world, meaning that their reference points are literally the Bible, not as an ancient text, but as their daily touchstone and reality. And in, for a very important part of religious Judaism in Israel, it's the Talmud, which is the interpretations of the Bible written down from oral law and then further interpretation roughly from the first century AD up to the fourth or fifth century AD. So there's a lot of truly medieval thinking underway, and even biblical primitivism, I would say. And in the Bible, it's pretty shocking when you read the Bible, the Old Testament, especially parts of the book of Deuteronomy and a book called the Book of Joshua. The Book of Joshua is after the first five books of the Old Testament, which is the Jewish Torah. The next book is about the conquest of the land of Canaan, which then became basically the land that is claimed by Israelis today. And that was through a conquest. In the Jewish lore, the Jewish story, Jews escaped from Egypt, from the burdens of the Pharaoh, where they were slaves onto Egypt. They escaped, led by Moses. They wandered in the desert for 40 years, and then they conquered the lands that had other people in it. So this is actually the religious story, and it's based on the idea that God gave a promise to the Jewish people that this would be their land. And when they conquer the land in the book of Joshua, it's literally genocides, one after another. There are named populations, and the instructions to the Hebrews that have come to conquer the land is kill everybody in it. Pretty strange, actually, I have to say. I'm very secular. Reading this as religion is pretty grim, that it's a command of genocide. It's not we had a war to conquer what God promised us, but rather the instruction is, don't be shy, Joshua. Don't hold back. Kill every man, woman, and child. And so it is a text, sad to say, of genocide and bloodshed. And then it's interpreted by rabbis in the Talmud afterwards. Okay, there's lots that can be said about ancient religious texts, but reading them literally as if it's the 2024 reality is not a very prudent thing to do, in my opinion. It is an invitation to mass killing. And the reason I go into all of this is that, sad to say, and it's shocking for me, is because I'm an American Jew, to hear rabbis speak in this way. Rabbis, a rabbi for me is a religious figure, and in my upbringing, the idea was a rabbi was a holder of ethics, you know, who helped to inform ethics in our Jewish community. But the ethics that the rabbis, not everyone by any means, so I don't want to be misunderstood, but there's a part of Israeli society that's very powerful politically right now, in which the rabbis talk about mass slaughter of Palestinians, as if it's basically the command of the Book of Joshua. And to hear this is stunning. There are tapes that one can find of rabbis who lead yeshivas, you know, these are religious schools, who are asked by their followers, and they're on video. These are then posted. Rabbi, do you mean to kill all the men and women? Yes, yes, they are all guilty. They are all supporters. They are our enemies. They want to kill us. Rabbi, do you mean to kill the children? Yes, yes, we should kill the children because they will grow up to be haters to kill us. And this is rabbis talking. So part of this that we're seeing of this lack of disguise of, you know, intention is actually deep belief that is not seen inside this belief system as something wrong, but as actually something religious. I'm sorry to say it. It's grim. And over time, there have been very knowledgeable religious Jewish critics in Israel over the last 50 years who wrote some important books that I had never read until the last year, and in fact, until recently in many cases, to try to understand what's going on, who warned about this, who said, look, this is what this strain of Judaism actually believes. It's not the Judaism I was at all inculcated with as an American, because grew up in America in what is necessarily a pluralistic society, and you don't base daily life on the Bible or on the Talmud, but some do. And then you get these unbelievable distortions that for me are completely shocking, but really are genocidal in clear intent and not hidden because they're not understood to be something to hide. They're understood to be something to follow God's will even. So this is part of the story. It's rather complicated. It's not the whole story, but it's definitely a feature of what's happening right now.
Oh, I agree entirely. And I think it's something that most people are afraid to touch upon because obviously this is, I mean, any kind of discussion of anything critical of Israel is immediately going to get you labeled an anti-Semite. But
by the way, you know, I can only surmise. I'm very well read in general because I've spent my whole life with a book in my hand, basically. And I try to pack in every day as much understanding as I can. And I've spent a lot of time trying to understand my own religious heritage and so forth. And I didn't know a lot of this until recently. And it was only looking at Smotrich and Ben-Gavir and hearing these horrible, horrible, horrible things coming out of their mouth, and then going back and understanding that there were some very sophisticated warnings and analysis about this by professors at Hebrew University and elsewhere, who were then ostracized, by the way, in Israeli society, you know, on exactly the grounds you said. But the reason I mention it is I really doubt that a lot of the American rich Jews who are very powerful in the Israel lobby in the United States have a clue about this. I don't think they know. I don't think they understand. Of course, they should be listening. They should be watching. And the basic point is, it cannot be right under any circumstances in the world to be killing civilians in mass numbers, no matter what, period. It's not even complicated. So I don't forgive them, but I do believe they don't understand actually even the cultural and in some cases the religious roots of this. And of course, you're not allowed to say it, but the basic point is we need to speak as truthfully as possible for our own survival. That's the basic point.
Absolutely. I agree entirely. I mean, I remember after September 11, there was open season on discussing how Islam contributes to terrorism, whether Islam is a religion of peace or Islam is a religion for terrorism. And I think that there's merit in having those arguments, whatever your opinion is.
Yeah. And by the way, you usually claims that it's a religion of violence by people who don't have the slightest idea of what Islam actually is, but by American evangelical preachers who dominated the American scene.
Absolutely. And I think it's a lot clearer, in fact, in Islam. Sure, some Muslims commit terrorism, but I think the injunction against harming women and children is pretty clear and uncontroversial, even if some people might today misinterpret it or interpret it in a different way or say that the conditions are different, so we need to carry it out. But it's very difficult to make an argument for it. It's a lot more complicated when it comes to the Bible and the Talmud, because the Talmud also is more complicated to read, because it's not as if it is out there giving you clear directive like Sharia law, which is saying you do this, you don't do that.
It's very, very complicated, by the way, except if you spent decades in a yeshiva, really know much about it.
And it's all about, you know, considering the viewpoint and the counter viewpoint and then coming up with other counter viewpoints. And it's rabbis adding on to this over decades and centuries. So it's, you know, it can get very controversial about what does this actually mean. So there's some pretty shocking verses about even raping children or things like that. But a more nuanced understanding is that, well, no, this is, they're making the argument, and they're making the argument for and argument against. I guess you could maybe make that case, but there is a big spectrum, and I think it's left unsaid that the part of that spectrum that is becoming dominant in Israeli policy over the past few years, but has always been extremely influential and was arguably very influential in 1948 as well, is the most hardline interpretation, which sees nothing but the idea that there's us, we're a tribe, and everybody who is going to get in our way deserves whatever is coming to them. And this is our land. God gave it to us. And so for me, the really horrific aspect of this is how it contradicts reality. Well, God gave you the land, and now there's children whose families have been living on that land for hundreds of years. Now, any civilized human being thinks, okay, this is property right. Those people own that property. I can't take it from them. But only it takes a special kind of religious fundamentalism to say, nope, that's completely invalid. It doesn't matter if you've owned that land. We can just completely get over that, and we're going to kick you out. And if you fight back, we're going to have to murder you and murder your entire family. And this is very mainstream.
Yeah, well, just to say, the history is complicated, and the complexities are, you know, fascinating, but they don't in any way change my perception of the immediate situation, which is that this is a genocide that needs to stop today. But just to say, the first Zionist of modern Jewish history, Theodor Herzl in Vienna, knew nothing about Judaism. You know, he's basically completely secular. He was not interested in the Holy Land per se. He was interested in a homeland for Jews, because nationalism at the end of the 19th century was the absolute predominant ideology of the world, that you weren't anything if you didn't have a nation. And so Herzl, who knew nothing about Judaism, looked around, and he had lots of ideas. Uganda, of course, was one famous place that he looked for. And history took its path, and Britain, definitely one of the most cynical countries in history, promised the land of what is today Israel and Palestine multiple times over to the Arabs, to the French, and to the Jews. So nothing like British perfidy. I think it's unrivaled. Whatever America knows, it learned from Britain, as far as I'm concerned. So in any event, that started, and most of the original Zionists were not religious. In fact, many were deeply secular socialists, anti-religious. And society became complicated. But for me, what my experience with Israel personally, of course, I have family in Israel, and therefore deeper relations. But my personal experience with Israel goes back to 1972, which was my first trip, so 52 years ago. And at the time, Israel was viewed broadly as a secular society. And of course, there was a religious component, but it was definitely a minority and, you know, even as today, looked down upon by the secularists and so forth. And the ideology of Israel was still pretty much a socialist kind of workers' party secular ideology. The Six-Day War was a, of course, one can go back and talk about 1947 and 48, and there's a lot to talk about, but I just want to start with 1967, because the Six-Day War had, practically speaking, the effects that have led us to today in two different ways. When I first arrived in Israel in 1972, just about the first thing that was explained to me was that Israel was going to establish settlements in the Palestinian captured territories. And the phrase that was introduced to me for the first time, I was a high school student, was to make facts on the ground. So this was a completely, in my view at the time, secular view. It had a mix of security. It had a mix of why not? We won this territory. But the idea was we're going to settle these occupied lands. And that was a plan by a famous general at the time, Alon. It was called the Alon Plan. And Alon was not doing it on the grounds of Deuteronomy or the Book of Joshua or anything else. He was doing it on a mix of, I think, for him, overwhelmingly security. Okay, we're going to have security outposts throughout the West Bank, on the Jordan River, et cetera, et cetera. And it became more generally an idea, you know, you win, you conquered, so we're going to make settlements. But then what happened, and I watched it, and I didn't understand it very well over time. Suddenly, there were demonstrations, or you'd see spontaneous dancing in the streets in the late 70s and early 80s of young people with, you know, religious skull caps, kippah in Hebrew, kippot, dancing in this zealous way. And I asked, what is this? And it was a group called Gush Emunim. And this is a new religious movement. Now, what was that? This was the New Settlers Movement, and it was led by rabbis, famous rabbis, who started preaching the religious line that this is our responsibility, almost a messianic responsibility, to settle these occupied lands because God gave us these lands. I believe, I'm not the deepest scholar in this, but I believe that there was a shift from the secularism, cynical, and so forth, but from the secularism to this religious movement that came with the settlements in the 1970s and 1980s. And there's some famous rabbis, Rabbi Cook, the old elder, and Rabbi Cook, the younger, his son, who promulgated a religious philosophy based on the Bible, that this is our land, God promised it, we're going to take it, and this is the redemption of the Jewish people through this. And of course, the settlements exploded in number to hundreds of thousands, and a lot of it was this religious movement. A lot of it was people who wanted swimming pools and cheap real estate, so it was also totally opportunistic. But a lot of it was the religious movement. My own guess is that this was really something new. And by the way, there were divisions in the Orthodox community, because one of the most powerful of the traditional Orthodox communities here in Brooklyn, the Satmar community, is absolutely anti-Zionist, saying, it's idolatry to give so much attention to the land. We need to give attention to our morality, not to the land. And so you can find rabbis standing outside of the UN holding signs that say Zionism is against Judaism. And so there ensued within the religious communities a debate and a division in the 1980s onward. And there is a religious Zionism, which is messianic. It's based on Deuteronomy. It's based on the book of Joshua. It's based on the Talmud. It's based on the things we were talking about. There are other strands of religious Judaism that say exactly the opposite. But what I think happened in Israel is that this religious zealotry gained weight. And, in game theory, as you know well, the weight does not depend strictly on your share of the vote or your share of the population or your share of seats in the parliament or the Knesset in Israel's case. It depends on whether you determine the governing coalition. And these religious parties that are in this nationalist religious line, and they're represented by this Bezalel Smotrich, for example, who is a leader of the settler movement and is a vulgarian and a genocidal figure, as far as I'm concerned, and a senior official in the cabinet, is one of these coalition makers. Netanyahu, who is absolutely one of the darkest and most cynical politicians in modern times, depends on this religious zealot for staying in power. We say in game theory that these small parties have high shapely values. It means that they have a high proportion of determining the coalition in power, even though they're not so dominant in the vote. And Ben-Gavir is another one. These are horrible people, in my view. They are murderous zealots. They believe what they say. That's why they're not hiding it. They speak to their followers. They have a huge weight in current Israeli politics because they'll bring down the government. And Netanyahu, who knows what his views are? He'll do anything and he'll kill women and children in mass numbers to stay in power. This is absolutely clear with Netanyahu. He's a perversion of politics in this way. But I think there was this change that is notable, maybe for Palestinians under the bombs. It's all very theoretical, what I've just said. But I think it's just important to understand how this evolved over time and why there really is this religious nationalist element to it that is barely understood in the United States. Because for American Jews, the ones that we learned about, talked about, admired, whether it's Ben-Gurion or Golda Meir or Abba Iban or Yitzhak Rabin or Shimon Peres, whatever one thinks of them, and I'm sure the Palestinians don't like them at all for any way, shape, or form, they are not these religious zealots. They were very different in their orientation, and something really has changed. And so we're seeing rabbis and we're seeing cabinet ministers openly calling for genocide, which was not the case 50 years ago.
The syllabus for my new online economics course, Principles of Economics, is now available on saifeddin.com. The course will take place over 18 lectures, each based on one chapter from my new book, Principles of Economics, which will be available for free as an ebook for everyone registering for the course. Lectures will be released once every 2 weeks on Mondays, starting on the 25th of September, 2023, and will be available in video and audio format. Live discussion seminars will be held once a week on Thursdays at alternating time slots, 12 hours apart, to ensure learners can attend from all over the world. I'm happy to announce that I have set up my new publishing house and online bookstore, The Safe House, which will be publishing and delivering the best Bitcoin and Austrian economics books worldwide in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook formats. Go to thesafehouse.com to buy my latest book, Principles of Economics, as well as the Fiat Standard and the Bitcoin Standard. And now I'm also publishing Fiat Food, Matthew Lisiak's amazing investigation into how inflation ruined our diet and health. And I'm also publishing Lynn Alden's Broken Money, her masterful exploration of the failures of the global financial system and how Bitcoin fixes it. This is a Bitcoiner's bookshop, so the books are printed in beautiful cloth hardcover made to last, with a nice colored dust jacket on top. Go to thesafehouse.com and get yours now.
Very true, very true. I think that's very astute. And I think I would say part of the shift is just demographics. Secular people in Israel have a much lower birth rate, whereas religious people have a higher birth rate. And I think to go back to the point that I made earlier, there's just too much room for interpretation of the text. So as you said, there are a lot of very religious Jews who are anti-Zionist and who see that Zionism as a nation state is an abomination for Judaism, because Judaism is a religion. It's not a nation, and it's not supposed to be a modern government. So you could interpret the Bible and the Talmud in all kinds of different ways. And I think the really concerning thing is that it's the dynamic of the Israeli government having the unflinching support of the United States that encourages all of the worst elements within Israeli society. Because the more conflict, the more settlements, the more conquering, the more war, the more murder, the more you can raise money in the U.S., the more you can get people agitated about this in the U.S., the more you can get the billionaires in the U.S. to start getting really agitated and threatening Harvard with to fires on all of that stuff. That's a lot of money. And of course, even more important than that, of course, is the military industrial complex, which stands to make enormous amounts of money. So it's a very perverse incentive where the government in its own, the fact that it has this enormous amount of money and power and weapons and the backing of the world's only superpower, is constantly encouraging the worst elements within Israeli society to come up to the fore, because more conflict is good for business.
Yeah, I think the situation in the United States is actually even simpler. And that is the Israeli lobby, by the way, which is this strange amalgamation of rich Jews to an important extent and evangelicals. Who have their own biblical literalism, looking for the Armageddon, which they think depends on Israel holding these lands, is simply very powerful in the U.S. and has been powerful for a long time, and has a lot of financial resources. And American democracy is $1, one vote. You know, it's basically a completely corrupt political system based on raising money for expensive campaigns. So the Israeli lobby has long had a high influence. From the point of view of most American Jews, I can tell you from my own experience, and I think it's pretty standard, support for Israel was deeply enculturated, for American Jewry, period. And again, it was not seen or foreseen that this was a genocidal impulse, and it was on overwhelmingly secular ground. So there's very little religious orthodoxy in the Israel lobby at all. You don't even hear about it. My own guess is the following, therefore, it's, again, not an insider's view. First, I don't think most wealthy American leader, political figures or leaders of the Israel lobby. And that's a lot of people on Wall Street, for example, a lot of very big money. I don't think they really understand much at all about this biblical or philosophical or religious nationalist or ideological view. It's more a knee-jerk support Israel, period. Israel's under threat, support it, period. So I think that there's very little understanding. And again, I'm being a little bit introspective because my own understanding needed a massive scaling up just to understand what was going on and who are these figures, many of whom I had never heard of before, until they became agents of genocide. So this is one part. Second, a politician like Biden, who's nothing but an old school politician, we have no idea what his real state of mind is, capacity to think or anything else right now, frankly. But his instinct completely is don't show a shade of gap with Israel. Now, by the way, even saying that, it's amazing how even Biden has been out there saying this is terrible what's happening and have some more bombs, by the way. So I don't think it's cynical, actually, although, of course, in outcome, it's profoundly cynical. It's pathetic is what it is. It's pathetic in that Biden, as a person, clearly sees this is horrendous. It's not a fake. It's not a disguise. But what's pathetic is how weak it is, because the guy, for God's sake, is president of the United States. And he should pick up the phone and say to Netanyahu, you're not getting any more weapons, period. Not with this mass killing. And the United States could shut this down in a day if it chose to. But it doesn't choose to, not because it supports genocide or ethnic cleansing, but because it's so deeply ingrained, don't get ahead of the Israeli lobby bulldozer. It's a bad thing to do. Now, even with all of that, you know, the American Jewish community is at this point pretty much in angst and deeply divided. It's in this way a little bit impressive, I would say, although you wouldn't think it's too impressive. But, you know, support for Israel is collapsing among the Jews in America. Not just among American society more generally. What's happening is disgraceful, disgusting, illegal, murderous. There's no other word for it, or words for it. And so this is actually permeating a lot of American society. But the political class doesn't live on public opinion. It lives on campaign contributions. And so one big billionaire campaign contributor outweighs a hell of a lot of percentage points of American public opinion till now. I'm not giving up. I'm speaking out because I want the United States to stop arming Israel, period. And not in weeks or months, today, this hour, this moment. And I'm making the point every day because I live in the UN context. We're the last bulwark for a genocide right now. No one else supports this in the whole world. By the way, no one else practically could support it. Some European countries like Germany are afraid to speak out for their own historical and political reasons. But it's only the United States practically that enables this to go on hour by hour. And so I'm trying to make the case in the US, we're completely isolated. It's completely horrible. It is not complicated. It is not complicated. It's not, oh my God, what are we going to do about Hamas and so forth? There are other ways to security than killing tens of thousands of people and starving hundreds of thousands of people. There is such a thing called diplomacy. And this is conveniently or inconveniently or obnoxiously forgotten by the United States because they're not trying diplomacy. But this is the real answer.
No, I agree with you, and I think the what you're saying is really very profound. I think for the vast majority of Americans, and I've lived in America, and the idea of Israel is just this romantic thing from Hollywood. I call it Harvey Weinstein Zionism, essentially, where you just get your ideas from all of these amazing Hollywood films where Israel is the underdog that's out there making the deserts bloom and being fought by all these irrational, crazy people who just hate them for the sake of hating them.
It's a good point, by the way. You know, the bestseller movie was Exodus, mm-hmm. not Nakba.
So, exactly.
You know, if there was Nakba, there would also be understanding of what this is all about. Yeah. So you could really have a human solution. But it is a set of images and not a deep understanding, which is a big problem.
And it continues to become more and more separated from the reality on the ground because, as you said, today's Israel is being controlled. I mean, the most important influential ministers are the two you mentioned, Smotrich and Ben-Gvir. And I think, I mean, you don't have anybody that can be in any way comparable within American politics. It's completely unimaginable for anyone to come up in the U.S. and say, we should do to blacks in the U.S. What? Imagine if just someone said exactly the same thing that Smotrich says. I mean, Ben-Gvir said, the need for my family to be able to drive around the streets of the West Bank is more important than anything for the Palestinians. Smotrich said, Palestinians have three options. They can leave, they can die, or they can live subjugated to Israelis. I mean, just imagine somebody.
And by the way, he put out a plan. It's not just a slogan. Yeah. He actually put out a plan. So you
it's very
have
elaborate.
A major Israeli minister with an elaborate plan of ethnic cleansing or murder or departure. It's unbelievable.
It is unbelievable.
But of course, people need to read that. They don't read that. They don't know. Again, even these, you know, the Israel lobby isn't exactly going out of its way to give us a reading list. And so you have to search this stuff out.
Yeah, absolutely. And the more time goes on, I think what's happening is just this cognitive dissonance that 6 months of just mass slaughter. I mean, conditioning and propaganda is very difficult to break, but I think a lot of people are beginning to just ask questions now because this doesn't sound like they're just out there to fight terrorism and get the hostages. I mean, there are certainly easier ways. It seems very clear, as many of the hostages' families are saying, it's very clear that the last thing Netanyahu wants at this point is a deal that frees the hostages. Because the real goal for him and for his coalition, it's a golden opportunity to use the hostages as an excuse to destroy all of Gaza, to use Hamas's intransigence and Hamas's fanaticism as an excuse to just destroy all Gaza, make it uninhabitable, and get hopefully a couple of million people to leave. That's what Smotrich said.
I think that's right. And if it isn't right, it would take 5 minutes for Netanyahu to make clear that it isn't right. Because all Netanyahu would have to say is, and you may then agree or not agree or whatever, but he would have to say, our enemy is Hamas, but we agree that there will be a Palestinian state, have no doubt about that. Of course, he's never going to say that. This is antithetical. But if he did mean that this is about Hamas, then there's a way to say that and not lose the other 191 UN member states, putting the United States in this limbo position as the 192nd, because there are 193 UN member states in all, and none support Israel to be the greater Israel, which is what Smotrich and Ben-Gvir certainly want, and what I think, I mean, certainly what Netanyahu wants as well. So if it were really about security, Israel could say so in a way that is, at least from that point of view, clear. But the fact that Netanyahu, at a minimum, prevaricates about the post-war situation in Gaza really means, of course, that the goal is not defeat Hamas. The goal is greater Israel. And there's not the slightest attempt to dissuade anybody from that supposition, which he could easily do.
Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to also ask you, you're in touch with RFK Jr. and you're working as an economic advisor, I believe, to his campaign, or...
Well, I'm a friend. We're classmates. I like him, but he does not have an acceptable position on this issue. I'm not endorsing him under these circumstances, because this is, to my mind, both in and of itself, extremely important. And as I've said to him, it's also a test. If you don't recognize this as a genocide, what do you do? And so I'm trying my best to explain my point of view to him, let me just say, almost all the time. so far, not clearly to any success.
Yeah, I think it's massively disappointing, because, I mean, he was one of the first candidates in a very long time in the U.S. that seems to be offering something different when he talks about foreign policy, when he talks about all kinds of issues. In monetary policy, he's open to Bitcoin and so on. Yeah. And then
I like Bobby a lot, and we've been friends for... We were in school together more than 50 years ago, to show my age, but also to just point out, we've known each other for a very long time. I like him enormously, but I cannot support a candidate that cannot get this right. I can't.
Yeah. And of course, your hero is his uncle, JFK, and you've written a book about his uncle and his quest. And what are your thoughts on the difference between the two of them, and how do you think JFK would have handled this?
Well, I tell Bobby all the time, be like your dad and your uncle, because they were both heroes for me. And I believe... Actually, I'm friends with a lot of the Kennedys, and I love the Kennedy family. And I love what Jack, President John F. Kennedy, and Robert Kennedy stood for. And Robert Kennedy was my first political love, because John F. Kennedy, I was too young. But Robert Kennedy, I was 13 when he was assassinated, and he was my candidate. And, you know, that stays with you your whole life. So what John F. Kennedy believed in and learned, especially almost the hard way, but learned in his brief presidency, was to negotiate and to try to find peaceful solutions. And he came into the presidency in 1961 saying in his inaugural address, let us never negotiate out of fear, but let us never fear to negotiate. He believed in talking. The next 2 years was very complicated and not very successful because the CIA put a plan on his desk to invade Cuba, and Kennedy went along with it to his counter to his instincts, but he did go along with it. And that was the Bay of Pigs, and it was a disaster. And it led Khrushchev to put in nuclear weapons into Cuba afterwards. And that brought us to the brink of nuclear annihilation in October 1962. And Kennedy was surrounded by advisors who said, take them out, military, invade Cuba, which would have likely led to nuclear annihilation. But Kennedy had the instinct, we can find a peaceful way out of this. And in a very complicated maneuver, when there was not a Zoom, not direct communication of global leaders, back channels, teletypes, slow communication, miscommunication, misunderstanding, he worked out a peaceful settlement with Khrushchev. And in the following year, he did what I regard as one of the greatest acts of statesmanship of modern history, why I wrote a book called To Move the World, JFK's Quest for Peace. He negotiated a peace treaty, in essence, with the Soviet Union in the form of the Partial Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. And what's amazing about it is, and hard for people to understand, negotiating with the Soviet Union in 1963 would be like Biden. I mean, it's possible, but Biden... it's never going to do it, would be like Biden standing up and say, I want to make peace with Iran, or I want to make peace with China. Of course, he should do that. And Kennedy had the guts to do it and succeeded and made a great treaty, but it took tremendous guts. And he made a great speech on peace in June 1963 that I absolutely adore. I think it's the greatest speech by a president in modern history, one of the greatest ever. That's what I wrote my book about, this peace campaign. And many people think, and I think it's absolutely plausible, that Kennedy was killed for his peace initiative in the same way that Yitzhak Rabin was killed for calling for peace, in the same way that Martin Luther King was killed for calling for racial justice, in the same way that Robert Kennedy was killed trying to get America out of the Vietnam War. I mean, we have a very dark side, and there's not a small chance that this was a coup in 1963 with the active CIA participation, at the least, that took Kennedy out. But to come back to your question, these were acts of incredible human insight of John F. Kennedy to save the world and then to move the world towards peace required a great decency and humanity. Decency and humanity can actually get you a long way. The first thing you do is you stop dehumanizing or vilifying the other, and you start understanding that they are human beings. They have a history, they have reasons, and in the case of Palestine, plenty of excellent reasons to want something different from what there is right now. And with some basic humanity, we could sort this out peacefully, not with slaughter or ethnic cleansing or genocide, but peacefully. Of course, we have a president who is, I think, almost surely physically incapable of doing this, but also by dint of his whole political career, intellectually and emotionally incapable of doing this as well. Biden has never been a peacemaker. Biden has always been an agent of the military-industrial complex. He's always been for NATO enlargement. He's always been for dirty tricks. He played a role in the overthrow of the Ukraine government in 2014. So I don't think he knows how to do this anyway, which is really terrible at this moment.
And it doesn't look like any of the three main options for the next presidential election is going to be any different. I mean, Trump seems to be similar in the sense of just being full on, give Israel everything they want. If he's critical of Biden, it's that he's not giving them enough. And JFK seems to be the same thing. I mean, it's amazing watching him just turn into evangelical Christian Zionist.
Yeah, the sad part about Bobby is that I think he'd actually win the presidency if he had the right platform, because everyone is so disgusted with Trump and Biden. I think Bobby could actually do it. And so even on purely pragmatic grounds, I wish he would do it. But of course, I want him to do it on deeper grounds, and I want him to do it on Kennedy grounds, which is make peace. It's possible. Don't dehumanize the other side. I keep telling him also, stop inflating Hamas as if it's this unbelievable monster that must be controlled and nothing can happen without addressing that. There are nations, there are other countries, there's diplomacy, there are ways to find peace. And so I'm hoping still somehow that he'll come to that, but it better be quick. Yeah. Otherwise, it's a lost campaign anyway.
And what are your thoughts on what's happening in Ukraine? I know you've been very outspoken about this, and you have very strong opinions about U.S. policy there. What are your thoughts on how that is going and where it is going?
Well, it's basically the same thing. It's a war that absolutely, unequivocally could have been avoided at repeated periods of time, many of which I know well because I was an advisor to Gorbachev and to Yeltsin and to Kuchma, the second president of independent Ukraine. I know this region well. And basically, Ukraine should have done what it said it was going to do when it declared independence, and that's remain neutral. And that's what the people of Ukraine wanted. They know that they're a bridge between Western Europe and Russia. As a bridge, be neutral on both sides. And they knew that, by the way, by overwhelming majorities. But the U.S. Military-industrial complex could not stand that. By the way, if there's one thing that American deep state hates, it is neutrality. It's not enemies. They love enemies. Enemies get you arms sales. They get you wars. They get you able to practice your military. But they hate neutrals. And the U.S. has a whole history of killing and overthrowing neutral leaders, by the way. It's stunning. And it's the old slogan, if you're not with us, you're against us. And they really believe that, because the statement is almost like a joke, like a caricature, you know, that Darth Vader would say in the Star Wars. But no, that's actually the American position. If you're not with us, you're against us. So they hate neutral leaders. And Ukraine wanted, the people understood this. They're so much Russian and ethnic culture and shared orthodoxy and faith and many other things. And so they wanted neutrality. They did not want NATO. And yet we had our neocons, Newland, who's about to become my colleague at Columbia. Oh, my God.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It'll be Hillary and Victoria. Yes, we said Ukraine has to become part of NATO. And that was a campaign that started in the late 1990s. Biden was absolutely on side on this. Victoria Nuland was first Cheney's advisor, then Bush's ambassador to NATO when they pushed for NATO enlargement, then Hillary's spokesperson, and then the assistant secretary of state for European affairs in 2014, when the U.S. actively participated in the overthrow of a neutral government and installed a government that said, we want NATO. So the war was provoked by NATO enlargement to this crazy degree. And by the way, completely against all the promises that had been made by George Herbert Walker Bush Sr. And James Baker III and others to Gorbachev back in 1990, that NATO wouldn't move one inch eastward. Anyway, it kept moving, kept moving, kept moving. And then it was supposed to move to Ukraine and even to the country of Georgia on the eastern coast of the Black Sea, which definitely is not a North Atlantic country, if one knows a little bit of geography. But it's this insanity of endless NATO enlargement. Well, suffice it to say, there were numerous exit ramps, and the United States refused all of them. And even after the special military operation started on February 24th, 2022, there was an immediate exit ramp, and that was the direct negotiations between Russia and Ukraine, calling for Ukrainian neutrality and agreeing on it in talks mediated by Turkey in Ankara. And they were close to an agreement, and the United States said, no, fight on, fight on. We don't accept neutrality, fight on. And here we are till today. And Biden absolutely does not talk to Putin. All he does is insult a counterpart who happens also to have 6,000 nuclear warheads and is beating to a pulp Ukrainians. And Biden's, clever ideas to call Putin a crazy SOB. You just cannot make this up. How immature, how puerile, how ineffective, how destructive the U.S. foreign policy is. It's just unbelievable. Any chance for peace, yeah, they reject because they don't believe in diplomacy.
For me, I think what is the most unconscionable thing about it is when American politicians say, look, we're fighting Putin and it's not even costing us any lives from our military. And it's just, for me, it's so callous and criminal to just, yeah, well, we're burning all these young Ukrainian boys and men, sending them to their graves.
It's not quite Smotrich and Ben-Gavir, but it's in the same ilk. You know, they literally say it's not American lives being lost. Richard Blumenthal, senator of Connecticut, explicitly on this, greatest bargain that money can buy. Lindsey Graham.
Yeah.
I can't even say on public company my true view of him. Mitt Romney. They're all like this. And so it is a kind of vulgarity. Safe, we're going to have to wrap up, I'm afraid. It's incredible to speak with
Likewise,
you.
We should have finished up on how Bitcoin fixes this. 10 years ago, I gave a presentation at Columbia and spoke to Bitcoin. You were a bit skeptical, but a couple of years later, you emailed me saying, okay, there's something there. So I just want to get a quick reaction from you. What are your thoughts on Bitcoin? And let me just tell you why I think it fixes it. If the U.S. government can't print money, 90% of all of these problems are thrown out the door. If you just can't hand over tens of billions of dollars to military contractors to keep promoting more and more wars, people are going to have to find a way to talk and reduce those conflicts. It's not going to end conflict, but I think conflict will be a lot less bloody.
Well, let's just say I agree completely that we need to find ways to talk, and we need to discuss Bitcoin because there's it's been an amazing ride. I'm still. I know it's completely contrary to probably almost every listener, but I'm still worried about completely unmonitored transactions, you know, for good or for bad, because I kind of believe in the rule of law. Admittedly, my belief is predicated on the idea that governments can be made to do the right thing. So I admit our whole conversation proves me wrong on that. and so I don't want to take an overly stark view of this. I'm not by instinct a libertarian because I believe there is such thing as the common good. And I believe I'm basically an Aristotelian in my philosophy. I believe that there can be government for the good. But I know that will run against the grain. And I have to say, I didn't give a single shred of evidence in favor of my views over the last hour of discussion. So I don't want to hold them too true and fast. I want to keep them open as provisional.
Okay, well, I want to be mindful of your time. Thank you so much. We should do this again. We should talk more often. We should get back in touch.
I hope so.
Thank you so much for the time.
Absolutely wonderful.
Cheers. Have a good day.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.